This is Alex Smith of Radio EcoShock with an 11th hour warning about our planet. Climate negotiations have failed. World-renowned scientists are calling for swift action to save the world's atmosphere right now, before it's too late. David Spratt is co-author of the book Climate Code Red, The Case for Emergency Action. He's just sent out a rather frightening update, and we'll talk with him now from Australia. The top scientists seem like near panic to me about this climate disruption. Can you tell us about the latest science and the prospect of global warming?
Well, I think what was interesting was that at Poznan a couple of weeks ago, there was a real push on by the scientists who, really get the big picture, saying that it was really important for there to be a post-IPCC update early next year before Copenhagen, because the IPCC report, which is now 18 months old and its cut-off point for the research was another 2 years before that, so that report is essentially 3 to 4 years old and is now so conservative as to be dangerous. And that's what a number of people like Ken Caldera and James Hansen and so on are saying. What does that mean specifically? We know that human emissions are going up faster than the worst scenarios. We know the greenhouse gases in the air are now tracking at worse than the worst, the most pessimistic scenarios of the IPCC. And then we have what's happening in the Arctic over the last 2 or 3 years, which is not dealt with at all in the IPCC report, which actually changes everything. And that's where our book started.
And, you know, it's kind of fantastic because I'm in Canada and I know lots of people in the United States. We're near that Arctic meltdown, and yet it hasn't really penetrated to the public consciousness what it means. What are the scientists saying? I mean, it took a little time to get this data together, I guess, to really figure out what it does mean.
Well, I mean, it started to happen that the IPCC said that the Arctic floating ice, which is the ice that just sits on the sea, historically averages about 3 metres in thickness, used to be an area of about 8 million square kilometres. I don't know why that compares to Canada, but it's about the size of Australia. They thought with global warming it would probably go towards the end of this century, in 100 years' time. What happened in September 2007, it actually dropped to half its usual size. It almost got there again in September 2008, even though the conditions were much cooler. So it's about half its size, but in addition, it's been thinning because about two-thirds of the heat that's been coming to the Arctic hasn't actually been coming directly from the sun. It's been coming from warmer currents, which is an indirect global warming effect. So you put those two together, thinning ice in a smaller area, and it means that in summer now, and it was certainly the case 3 months ago, that 80% by volume of the Arctic ice is now being lost in summer. And the predictions are, I think it could happen next year. Certainly within the next 10 years, we will have an Arctic that is ice-free in summer, and that has just huge, huge consequences for regional warming, for climate on the west coast of the United States, for the stability of the permafrost, particularly in Siberia. So as one climate scientist says, what starts in the Arctic doesn't stop in the Arctic, and that's the really big issue.
Another thing that's really bothering me is how, and you mentioned this in your update, that Western governments have found trillions of dollars all of a sudden to pay off bad bets by the banks and practically nothing to deal with climate change, the real big threat. Now, I know Barack Obama, he's appointed a great science advisor in John Holdren, but what else should Obama be looking at here?
Well, I've talked about climate in the ways dealt with at the international negotiations and by the national governments I've seen. I mean, we had a change of government here 12 months ago from a very conservative government to a centre government, and they've just brought out a carbon pollution reduction scheme plan, a carbon trading plan, which will actually mean that Australia will produce more CO2 in 2020 than it does now, which has appalled everybody. I think the problem is that governments, one, are not on top of the science. They're dealing with IPCC science. They don't know what's going on in the Arctic. They probably don't know they don't want to know what's going on because it's more than inconvenient. Secondly, because of that, they're setting targets which are far too low. I mean, we've heard a lot of debate, even in Poznan, about the need for the Annex 1 countries, the advanced capitalist countries, to reduce their emissions by 25 to 40% by 2020 over 1990 levels. That's sort of the mantra. But that would produce temperature rises of 2.5 degrees, which would take us past several tipping points. It would probably slip the system to 4 or 5 degrees. So they're bad on targets. And I think the thing that we discovered most in writing the book is that governments want to see climate policy as something that you can negotiate or compromise about. I mean, they just see it as another political issue. We have a centralised wage-fixing system in Australia where you have essentially the unions on one side and the employers on the other, and you always have a compromise down the middle, a trade-off. And governments think that on climate that you can engage in compromise and trade-offs, and as I have been fond of saying recently in Australia, is they don't understand that you can't negotiate with the laws of physics and chemistry. It's a really dumb thing to do. So in terms of what Obama should do, I think, one, he should absolutely get a latest science update so he's got an evidence base for making decisions. He should be honest about that. He should be honest about that with the American people, because it's too late to pretend and live in fantasy land. Secondly, he's got to understand and talk about the conclusions that you draw from that. And the conclusions which James Hansen and many others are drawing is simply this: there is too much carbon in the air. Now, James Hansen says that to get the Arctic ice back, which we absolutely have to do, because if we don't, you get a 5-degree regional warming, because light reflective ice is replaced by dark heat-absorbing sea. That's happening already, which is why August temperatures in the Arctic this year were 5 degrees warmer than usual. We're already seeing that starting to happen. That will have two consequences. The first is that the ice sheet on Greenland, which is a 7-metre sea level rise, will melt. If there's no Arctic sea ice, Greenland will go. There is no way it can stay. And secondly, if you get that 5 degrees of regional warming plus a few other factors, you'll probably destabilise the permafrost, and there's double the amount of carbon in the permafrost in the air, and that would just be the end of the game for all of us. So I think he has to say, we have gone too far, there's too much up there, we have to reduce the amount of carbon in the air, we have to go for zero emissions. This is just, from a scientific point of view, non-negotiable, and then you can start talking about the money.
Well, you mentioned the new Kevin Rudd government in Australia, but that's something that makes me feel a little helpless on climate, because I've been saying to myself, well, once something terrible happens and it's obviously climate change, then people will demand action. And it did happen in Australia with that decade-long drought, and the public voted for climate action, and now the government can't or won't do it. There seems to be a stall. So if politics doesn't work, what then?
Well, I think the problem is that people wanted to believe that the government would do more than it could. There's a bloke called Ken Ward, who's Deputy Director of Greenpeace in America, who says that one of the great climate delusions, particularly from the large green organisations, is to believe that climate is about policy. He says it's about power. And we've seen that the same thing here, where the large green climate advocacy organisations cuddled up to the new government, was nice to them, gave them lots of policy options, didn't try and mobilise people, didn't put real pressure on members of parliament, and we've got the result we have. I think this requires a huge mobilisation of people. If we don't inflict serious pain on politicians, they simply won't move, because they are beholden to in Australia, in particular, the coal lobby, which is large and dominant in, obviously, North America, the oil lobby. We have to inflict political pain. I think the other thing, coming from the other side of politics, is there are more people in business in Australia, and I think around the world, than in government, who understand that there's no jobs and there's no profits on a dead planet. I mean, we have people here at the top of the business cycle who absolutely support us in our demand for zero emissions and the cooling of the planet and what we have called an emergency or war economy transition to a low-carbon future. And I think we need to mobilise them as well, because we know in the advanced Western countries that these governments will probably only change when business tells them to, because they run the show. And I think some effort should be put in that end as well, because it is certainly clear that business is well ahead of government in Australia.
I think that's true in America too. Increasingly, there are various movements from business, and you're right, no profits on a dead planet.
I mean, we see T. Boone Pickens, when Gore announced something, which was a wonderful thing to do, his challenge to American politicians in July about creating a 100% renewable electricity system in 10 years, which I think is absolutely consistent with the science. They had T. Boone Pickens, who's a Texas oil man, made even more money out of hedge funds, so I understand it, saying, oh, I want to put billions and billions into solar energy, and that's the sort of message we have to hear as well.
Yeah.
I mean, in terms of the question you asked before about money in banks, I mean, the mantra we've had all the time is, oh, look, we can't afford this. We can't afford this. We can't afford this. I mean, it was odd in Australia because a report was done by McKinsey and Company for Australia, which I think was an offshoot of an international report they did. And for Australia, they showed that of all the emissions reductions, the first quarter, roughly, would be cost positive. That is, in the medium term, they would cost less than the savings. For example, you put hot water systems on household roofs, and the cost of that is less than the power bills that you save. So the first quarter would be cost positive. So it's always been delusionary for governments to say we can't afford this when it will save money. But I think the financial crash has shown that when there are bad bank managers who make bad and stupid decisions, the world can put trillions and trillions of dollars, I mean, it's probably, you know, going to end up being $10 trillion or something, into remedial measures. So for bad bank managers, if we can find $10 trillion, when the planet is in peril, they can't find a cent. And that, I think, is now clear to people, and it's certainly clear to the people around Barack Obama who are talking about a Green New Deal. Whether, of course, they'll deliver is another question. But I think that the people he's appointed and the statements they're making there are certainly signs of good intent. And I guess we'll have to wait till next year to see whether they are realised or not.
We're talking with researcher and author David Spratt from Australia about emergency action to save our climate. And I want to get back to the science for a minute, David. How credible are the new warnings about Arctic methane getting into the atmosphere?
Look, it's a bit early to tell. There was some very credible evidence given at the American Geophysical Union Conference in San Francisco last week, which is the largest gathering of climate science for the year. What they have detected is permafrost is permanently frozen ground. I mean, think of Siberia, think permafrost. The northern part of your country as well. There is also permanently frozen ground under the seabed. And what they're detecting is that some of that is melting, so you're getting methane bubbling up through seawater into the surface, which is disturbing. The reason for that probably is that you're getting much warmer currents up there, the sort of the warmer ocean fluxes that have melted most of the Arctic sea ice may be starting to destabilise some of that methane. What we don't know at the moment is how large the problem is presently and what the trajectories would be. So there's no modelling of it. I mean, if a substantial amount of methane, either the land-based or the ocean-based methane, were to be warmed and to be mobilised, that would be the end of the planet as we know it for most people and most species. It is a very bad sign, but it hasn't been quantified enough yet for us to be able to say how bad, how soon.
Good enough. Well, another question that one listener asked me is, what is the climate carbon cycle? What does that mean?
Well, we have large amounts of carbon which are stored and exist in various parts of the biosphere. So the one we obviously know about is that there is carbon in the air. That's the smallest amount. There is carbon in the oceans. I mean, a cubic meter of water will hold 1,000 times, apparently, more water, more carbon than the same amount of air. So we have the air, we have the oceans, we have the soils. I mean, we have carbon obviously stored in the form of oil and carbon, but also organic material in soils. and deeper down. And then we have the carbon, which is stored in the living earth, in rainforests and trees and so on. So we have these banks of carbon, and obviously there is a circulation between them. When we burn coal or oil, we're liberating carbon from the ground and putting it into the atmosphere. There is a constant interchange between the atmosphere and the ocean, year in, year out, where carbon is taken down and released. And so we can see this circulation of carbon between these various reservoirs. What's happening at the moment, of course, is that we're liberating carbon from the soil, also from living material with the destruction, particularly of rainforests in the Amazon and closer to us here in Australia, in Indonesia, and the destruction of rainforest, the trees are killed, they're burned, and the carbon pours into the air. So that's the carbon cycle.
Because I've read a paper recently called Climate Carbon Cycle Feedbacks by Andrew McIntosh and Oliver Wouldring. And one thing in it that I found really frightening was, it seemed to me they were saying, and you can correct me on this, but it seemed to me they were saying the probability of holding greenhouse gas levels at 550 parts per million was unlikely. And we might be heading towards 650 parts per million. Now, people like James...
Well, that's a dead planet.
That's a dead planet. And how can
that's
we debate whether to go there or not?
And that's a delusional bait. I mean, Sir Nicholas Stern brought down a report two years ago for United Kingdom saying, look, we should aim for 450, but it's too difficult, so we'll try for 550. The implications of the policy that the Australian government has just brought down is probably 550 to 650. I mean, this is why I call the debate delusional, because these people do not connect these abstract numbers to real-lived impacts. And one of the problems we have is that as the Earth warms, we find, for example, that at less than 1 degree, we are warming the Arctic to the extent that the sea ice will go. The lack of sea ice will warm the Arctic region by 5 degrees, and that's going to be probably getting close towards enough of an increase to mobilise large amounts of permafrost carbon, which is a carbon cycle feedback. This is why we say we need emergency action. I mean, the notion that we can leave this to the market, put a price on carbon and stop runaway global warming, I think is another delusion. This is the greatest threat to mankind that we have ever experienced since we've been on this planet. I have no doubt of that. Sir Nicholas Stern said that the effects would be greater than the two 20th century great wars and the Depression put together. That is really on the light side. I mean, we are now facing the extinction of most life on Earth. And that's why we say we need a whole of society mobilisation. This is really serious. This is not just an issue. It is the issue. I think in some ways it's the only issue. I don't know why environment organisations, from a macro point of view, bother to campaign on anything else other than climate, because if we don't get the climate solutions, all the other issues will become irrelevant. And this requires the sort of mobilisation that we see in wars. I mean, we know, for example, in the year after Pearl Harbor, that the United States economy was transformed from the largest producer of consumer goods in the world to the largest producer of military goods in 12 months. Now, being a large producer of military goods in itself is not a good thing, but it just shows that if you want to transform an economy, if you want to transform an energy system, you can do it, but you can't do it in what we would call politics as normal mode.
I think that's a transformative interview. I'm going to have to leave it there. I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock. Our guest is David Spratt. He's the co-author of the book Climate Code Red, The Case for Emergency Action. It's published by Scribe Books in 2008. Be sure and visit his website at climatecodered.net. Thanks for your passion and hard work, David. Will you keep us posted?
My pleasure. And just to say, early in the new year, the book will be available in North America on Amazon as well.
Excellent. We'll look for it. Thanks again. Broadcast on 16 stations in Canada and the United States. Going out over the world by satellite and cable, podcast and downloads, you've got Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith. Get tons of free MP3 downloads from our site at ecoshock.org, ECO, shock like an electric shock. It's radioactive. You're listening to Radio EcoShock on Green 960 AM, San Francisco. This is Alex, and I'm going to leave you with some homework. The sudden economic downturn leaves us with two new pressing problems facing the world's climate and all living species. Will the developing depression slow the growth of human-induced greenhouse gas emissions? Because so many factories shut down, because so many fewer miles are driven already in the United States, because people cut back on consumer luxuries, could the economic crisis unknowingly give us an extra year or two and the motivation to change away from deadly carbon energy systems? Will the same collapse of the economy trigger a sudden rise in temperature as factories pollute less? That lowers the layer of pollution reflecting some of the sun's energy in a phenomenon known as global dimming. In a minute, I'll play you a quote from Sir James Lovelock explaining the rapidity of human-made climate change and the hairy risk of a sudden cutback of pollution. Here is the clip of Gaia inventor James Lovelock speaking to the Royal Society in Britain on October 29, 2007.
The long-term history of the Earth suggests the existence of hot and cold stable states, what the geologists often refer to as the greenhouses and the ice houses. The best-known hothouse occurred 55 million years ago at the beginning of the Eocene period. In that event, between 1 and 2 teratons of carbon dioxide were released into the air by a geological accident. Putting this much carbon dioxide in the air caused the temperatures of the Arctic and temperate regions to rise about 8 degrees Celsius and the tropics 5 degrees. And it took about 200,000 years for conditions to return to their previous state. In the 20th century, we injected about half that much CO2, and we and the Earth itself now look soon likely to release more than a teraton of CO2. Global heating, 55 million years ago, took place much more slowly than now. The injection of gaseous carbon compounds into the atmosphere may have taken place over a period as long as 10,000 years, instead of about 200 as we are now doing. The great rapidity with which we are adding carbon gases to the air is as damaging in some ways as the quantity. There are other differences, of course, between the Earth 55 million years ago and now. The sun was 0.5% cooler, and there's no agriculture anywhere, so that natural vegetation was free to regulate the climate. Another difference was that the world then was not experiencing that strange phenomena, global dimming. The 2 to 3 degrees of global cooling caused by the atmospheric aerosol from man-made pollution. The haze from it covers most of the northern hemisphere and offsets global heating by reflecting sunlight, and more importantly, by nucleating clouds that reflect even more sunlight. The aerosol particles of the haze persist in the air for only a few weeks, whereas carbon dioxide persists for 50 to 100 years, so that any economic downturn or planned cutback in fossil fuel use, which lessened the aerosol density, would intensify the heating. And if there were a 100% cut in fossil fuel combustion, it might get considerably hotter, not cooler. And this is why I sometimes say I think we live in a fool's climate. We're damned if we continue to burn fuel and damned if we stop too suddenly.
That was James Lovelock. Thank you for listening. I'm Alex Smith. Check out our website for past shows and our podcast. It's all free for the sake of the planet. Adios, muchachos.